Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice, where our mission is to foster peace and cultivate justice and create a safer world. We're honored to have with us Dean Paula Cordero from the School of Leadership and Educational Sciences, and of course our own dean, William Headley of the Joan B. Kroc School of Peace Studies, which is now accepting its applications for its new program this fall in Peace and Justice Studies. However, we also have in the audience our current MA Peace and Studies class, and we really want to welcome them and invite them to enjoy our most accomplished guests, a diplomat who has toiled in some of the most difficult and dangerous regions of the world, as well as the halls of many capitals and the United Nations. Well, you can read the brief little bit in your program about the speaker's 40 years of diplomatic experience. It can hardly be squeezed into a few paragraphs or a few volumes. We're going to have him write that book he's talking about to let us really know what went on, but it's going to be like a series, I'm sure. Diana Kotlow, our senior program officer in charge of the Distinguished Lecture Series, keeps a chart of speakers, ranking them in different areas of expertise. Tonight's speaker has been ranked on the top of the chart of almost every theme and region we've covered: weapons control, conflict prevention, humanitarian action, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Mozambique, the Balkans, and on and on. During these years of diplomatic work, he's also been an innovator, serving as the first Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs at the United Nations, an area which has grown tremendously in importance over the years and which is very important for those of us who work in the field of peace building. He's also launched much-needed reforms during his tenure as President of the UN General Assembly. In a new book by Dennis Ross, the former Bush and Clinton administration Mideast envoy and negotiator, he says, "The international realities we face in the early 21st century demand our understanding, effective assessments, the ability to match our objectives and our means, the know-how to wield influence well and to get others to do what we want, and the skillful application of all the policy instruments at our disposal. In this more complicated world, in which knowledge is more widely shared, resentments are more intensely felt, and the use of power is more likely to be constrained, we have little choice but to become far more adept in exercising every aspect of statecraft." Well, Jan Eliasson is a gentleman and a diplomat who has understood and used this level of statecraft throughout his career. And when the policies and the vision are not sufficient to do what was needed to address the challenges he saw and faced, he worked to change them at the UN and elsewhere. This is a gentleman who listens to and gets women involved in peace dialogues, which some of you know is important to us here. And he continues to share his expertise and his experience as a visiting professor at Uppsala and Gothenburg universities in Sweden, and several European and American universities, two of which have granted him an honorary doctorate degree. He's the chairman of the Anna Lindh Memorial Fund of Sweden and a member of the advisory group to the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC in Geneva. We thank our truly distinguished guests for joining us this evening, and in advance of presentation he's going to be giving tomorrow to the NROTC and at the law school for students. On behalf of our IPJ teams returning from Guatemala, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Mindanao, in the Philippines, where they've been seeing the faces and listening to the voices of civilians caught in armed conflicts in recent times, I invite all of you to join me in welcoming the man who, after he's seen all and done all these things, still claims to be an optimist, if a little worried a lot of the time, Ambassador Jan Eliasson.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aker, dear Dee. This was a wonderful introduction.
To the young people, I want to say that I'm
Sorry that it also discloses my age, having done all that. I must tell you a story where the introduction did not end up in such a wonderful way that Dee did it. I was in New York, had done the humanitarian operations in Somalia and Sudan and Burma back in the early 90s, disaster areas all over. And I was given a reception at the end. The lady was very kind and gave a very good account of what I had done, but she ended up in a way which sort of changed the whole spectrum and the whole angle of what I had been doing, because she said, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce you the man responsible for all disasters in the world." I felt that was somewhat unfair. Thank you very much. And also thank you very much to all of you, Diana and others, for a wonderful reception. I have been met with such warmth, and the atmosphere of serenity here in this surrounding is extraordinary, and it's a gift, I would say, to the students to be at such a place. It really is inspiring. I also want to say, as a Swede, having left my country last week with snow on the ground, that I realized why I love my own country, namely the summers, but I also realized that the winters are the reason I joined the Foreign Service. And here I'm doubly reminded of the wonderful environment in which you live here. I want to commend the John Crook Institute for the justice and peace accent that you have on your work. No justice without peace, and no peace without justice. But I also want to commend you for putting such a strong emphasis on human security. The need to put the human being in the center is urgent in today's world. I think we are failing in this. We have not achieved human security. And I would share with you maybe a bit of disappointment in what happened, or rather what did not happen, in two situations in the post-war period. The first one was at the end of the war, the Second World War. The historians here may dispute this, but I would claim that the period between 1930 and 1945 probably was the most horrible nightmare in human history. If you add up communism in the Stalin fashion, fascism and Nazism and Second World War, Holocaust, that period between 1930 and 1945 is, to me, a true nightmare. And then what happened, interestingly, in history is there a pendulum effect. 1945, people meet in San Francisco to try to create the basis for a new world, an international solidarity, peace and security. The founders of the United Nations, those who authored the UN Charter. At the same time, Secretary Marshall devised the Marshall Fund to bring together, through reconstruction and cooperation, learning from the First World War experiences, that it's better to start a period of reconstruction and, in the end, cooperation with the Marshall Program. A couple of years later, the European Union started in its first shape, the Coal and Steel Union, which had little to do with coal and steel, but actually basically dealt with stopping wars between France and Germany. And 1948, on the 10th of December, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came out, with Eleanor Roosevelt as a prime mover. Look at this explosion of goodwill and wanting to leave this nightmare behind and create a new world. That was a moment, a great moment, great opportunity, wasn't it? And then came the Cold War. The suspicion between systems, and the human security did not rank very high up on the agenda during the Cold War. During that period, nations and people became pawns in a geopolitical chess game. And we forgot what we intended to do that period between 1945 and 1950. So that was the first disappointment in my view. Then came the second. We were all extremely happy. You all remember the great relief, the joy we felt when the wall fell down in Berlin 1989 and the Cold War was over. The system that was lost from the beginning recognized its failure, and we saw the end of the Cold War. But then, when that wet blanket of the Cold War was lifted away, it turned out that there were so many forces that had been suppressed for so long time. Ethnic minorities, religious minorities, the superpowers' influence was lifted away, and domestic forces started to move. In many places, they were not democracies. So it turned out to be a period where, to us diplomats, to a surprising degree, conflicts erupted again. But more and more in the form of civil wars, disputes, conflicts, wars inside nations, which in a way was my second disappointment. That this dream of the end of the Cold War would lead again to putting human security high up on the agenda. So that challenge remains. The challenge remains to really put the human being in the center and perhaps achieve the goal that solidarity, this fine word, solidarity does not stop at a border, but at human beings in need. But during that Cold War period, and even to the founders of the United Nations, sovereignty and territorial integrity was and is such a strong concept that those concepts prevail over humanitarian conditions and the situation of human rights in the country. And we see that challenge today. We see it in Sudan, I'll come back to that. We see it in Zimbabwe, and we see it in Burma. Does solidarity stop at a border or at human beings in need? It does, in fact, mostly stop at a border. What can we do about it? I'll come back to that, hopefully. So let me go to the situation as it is around the world now. And it's not a pretty picture, but I promise you that I will have a bit more positive remarks to make later on. Dee was hinting that I was an optimist. I say that I am an optimist. But nowadays, I always add, I'm an optimist, but I worry a lot. So let's look at the costs to the civilians in armed conflict. First of all, let's just note the statistics. I'm not sure about the exact figures, but I think they are approximately are correct. During the First World War, 10% of the casualties, approximately, were civilians. 90% were military. The most horrible form of killing took place, particularly between the border, Germany and France. Second World War, the figures were approximately 50%, 50-50. 50 million people were killed in the Second World War. But I mentioned also the other horrible series of events, tragedies, and it all adds up approximately to 50% civilians and 50% soldiers, military personnel. What is it today? Many of it, you know it. It's a remarkable shift It's almost the reverse of the Second World War. Today, it's 80 to 90% civilians who are killed in the conflict today, the international ones and the civil wars. That is a striking figure. It is the civilians that mainly pay the price in the conflict today. Now, why? Well, the civil wars tend to give more lead to more casualties among civilians. You have the proliferation of weapons. You see it all over the world. You see it, by the way, close to you, I guess, in Mexico. And you have also the ever deadlier weapons, machines to kill to a degree that has never existed in human history. And then you have, of course, the risk that this also may turn into use of weapons of mass destruction. I myself have personally seen the use of chemical weapons when I saw Iranian soldiers coming back from the front in the war with Iraq, 1982-83, used by Saddam Hussein's Iraq to begin with, and nothing was done about it. I still sense a bitter disappointment that so little was done, and that no warning and no sanctions were exercised against Saddam Hussein. If that had taken place when he started the use of chemical weapons towards Iran, then perhaps we would not have seen the incredible, horrible experience of Halabja of March 1988, when Saddam Hussein sent chemical weapons to Halabja, killing 5,000 people, mostly women and children. Now, secondly, women and children are the most exposed, the most vulnerable. And this is used, unfortunately, sadly, tragically, brutally, cruelly, cynically, as a method of warfare, introducing fear, not only inflicting damage, but also sending a message of fear into the conflicts. You see it in Congo. You've seen it in Sudan, of course. Well, I can't name it. There are so many situations where it's used systematically to instill fear among the population. And this also goes for the case of rape. Rape is used systematically, particularly in the Congo conflict. Now, fortunately, the Security Council of the United Nations has decided to make rape a war crime. And this is a great step forward, Security Council Resolution 1820. It's important that that is, of course, implemented and respected. You have also the terrible phenomenon of child soldiers. When you see that and meet them, I met some of them who came back, more or less brainwashed, 9-10-year-old boys with AK-47. And they are probably easier victims, easier to convince of doing these horrible things than grown-ups. But they are almost destroyed, although I've seen some fantastic examples of recovery recently. And lastly, in this horrible list of issues, sorry to bring up such sad features, but we have to see realities as they are. The trafficking. 1.2 million women and children are sold in sexual exploitation around the world. I claim that we have slave trade in the world. 1.2 million women and children are sold as merchandise in the sex trade. But probably 6-7 million furthermore are sold as forced labor. And that is something that happens very much in conflict situations. Last point is on this list of how it looks today when you see the problems, because you have to identify the problems first before you start trying to do something about them. The refugees and the internally displaced people. You know, of course, the difference. You become a refugee when you get across the border. When you stagger across the border, you turn from an IDP, an internally displaced person, to a refugee. And as Diana Kotlov and I discussed today, by that you change the status. When you become a refugee, the 1951 Convention is applicable, and you have a stronger legal protection. But believe it or not, among the probably... I only have the 2007 figures. I think it's now... The 2000 figures are 31 million refugees and displaced persons in the world. And believe it or not, the majority are displaced persons. So there are more, if I may say so, refugees inside nations than there are those who have succeeded in crossing into another country. And that, I think, is an illustration of the degree of violence, conflict, and often suppression of minorities that exist in so many countries within nations. Let me give you the example of Sudan, where I worked the last 18 months until July last year. You have 2.5 million internally displaced people in Darfur. The population is 6.5. So every third Darfuri is an internally displaced person living in camps. They have lived there now, many of them, 4 to 5 years. And it's a sad experience to meet with people inside those camps. I remember a 17-year-old boy who was very bitter. I tried to talk to him. It was hard, but I found out that he felt ashamed. His father could not go out and farm. His mother risked being raped when she was out searching for firewood or water. And he himself was unemployed and, of course, couldn't do anything in there. And he was saying that there were groups that asked him to take up arms and also instigate violence inside the camps. And of course, you know from the Middle East what happens when you have a refugee situation that just becomes a festering wound, an infected wound, and that very much is a risk in Sudan. When I left, I reported to the UN Security Council in June, and I said there are two ticking bombs. One is what happens in the camps if there is no hope for return, with the frustration and anger that will grow there. And the second danger is that the land that the people have left out in the country to go to the camps is now taken over by people who don't own that land. So one day we will have the problem of the people from the camps returning to their villages, finding that someone else is sitting in their homes, tilling their land. Here I should say a few words about today's situation. You know that 13 humanitarian organizations have been expelled from Sudan, mainly from the Darfur area. And there is now a risk that 1 million people will lack food, medicine, and in many cases water in the next 3 or 4 weeks. So we have actually a desperate situation at hand right now. And I think the solution must be a combination of different steps. The first one would, of course, be to hopefully have President Bashir retract his decision in the interest of saving his own population. But if that doesn't happen, I think there is a need, as we discussed today at lunch, some of us, a mobilization of efforts from the remaining organizations, which is about the equal number, I think, inside, who continue to work, that they are given the resources, the personnel, the money, to strengthen their organization, to compensate as much as possible for those who leave. But to do that in such a short time is extremely difficult. The other hope that some have, although there are problems with that, is that the government realizes that they now have a larger responsibility to prove the point that there is not going to be a humanitarian disaster by distributing food, medicine, and other supplies more fairly so that the Darfuri people will get that. But that might be wishful thinking. And there are also those in the camps who do not want to receive food from the government side. So that's a problem. A third consequence, which has not been discussed so much in the press as I have seen, is a problem that I think could arise, and that is that many people in the camps may think that the situation will become critical, or is critical, and therefore they will decide to cross the border and get the support in Chad, where the humanitarian organizations continue, and where the UNHCR is active, and where the legal obligations are there to help out. And over there, there are about 200,000 refugees from Sudan. That figure could grow very much. So here are different scenarios for what might happen. But I think it's urgent, and decisions about action has to be taken very soon to avoid a huge disaster. Again, I would say, in Darfur. Okay, I promise you, this is it. The dark picture is over. But we need to see that, because what can we then do about this? Well, I think the first point I'd like to make is to really start a movement or really increase the our voices and enhance our message that there has to be respect of international law, and there has to be respect of international humanitarian law. There is so much that actually the countries of the world have promised to do, which they are now forgetting. We don't know enough about the 1949 Geneva Conventions and all the other instruments that we have, and from the UN Charter onward, to protect civilians. If you notice these rather dangerous trends and facts that I have enumerated, it's sort of a historic irony that we have left the nightmare of 1930 to 45 behind us. We have left the Cold War behind us. And we are still not achieving what we must do, namely reach a level of human security which restores the dignity of man around the world. And therefore we have to do this educational work, get back to the facts, read the commitments that you have made. The Geneva Conventions state very clearly that the civilians must be protected. We made reference to that, Olof Palme and I was mediating in the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, and there was indiscriminate bombing of the villages in the border area Iran-Iraq. And some of us just picked up the Geneva Conventions and said to the Iranians and Iraqis, are you crazy? You cannot just bomb these villages. They are 95% civilians. It's a terror action from both sides. And we achieved actually an agreement which is not very well known. On the 11th of June 1984, both sides committed themselves not to bomb the villages in the border areas. And we made reference to the Geneva Conventions. 1993, I was in Sudan in another conflict. It was the war between North and South. And there was an area of 50,000 people who was really isolated by the conflict and by landmines surrounding this area. And the Norwegian church, relief church organization, which was very strong in Juba, in southern Sudan, sent a warning. I was then Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, and said, "You have to come. It's if you don't come in here and open up this area, 50,000 people may starve to death." So I went there to Khartoum and tried to negotiate. What to begin with, we started negotiate a local ceasefire. But of course, that didn't work because the local ceasefire required the consent of the military. And also required observers, monitors. So we fortunately, before we had to leave, thought of something new. We said, let's, instead of a local ceasefire, go for a humanitarian corridor. This was the first time that concept was introduced. So we got the agreement from the government and later on from the movements to open up a humanitarian corridor to this area. We would save everybody in that area, whether it was government-controlled or rebel-controlled villages. It was for a particular duration. The beauty of it was that the government didn't have to sign an agreement with the SPLM, with the rebel movement. They didn't want to give legitimacy. We simply said, you make a commitment to us, the United Nations. And that worked. And that, again, we made reference to the humanitarian legislation that exists and apart from the humanitarian conscience. And believe it or not, 3 weeks later, 29 landing places had been cleared, and a month later, the Juba was opened. The Nile was opened to the Juba, and that population was saved. So things can be done. You can do something if you know, first of all, the legislation, the legal framework, but also if you also use a little bit of innovative solutions. Also, UN Charter, I carry it with me often. I have it here. Article 51 says that you have a right of self-defense. It's very clear. You have a right of self-defense. Israel was exercising that right of self-defense in the Lebanon War 2006. And in the Gaza fighting 2008 and 2009. But it's also irrefutable, in my view, that, and that is clearly the conclusion of most lawyers, all lawyers practically, that the response has to be proportionate. It has to be a proportionate response to the use of force. And if there is a disproportionate response, this is not in line with international law. That again needs to be brought out. I think there is a need to go back to the sources and use the authority of the negotiations that were behind this laborious, long work to create a legal framework which defends human dignity. Another thing is that the peacekeeping operations of today have more and more a humanitarian mandate. To some, this is questionable because there is a risk that you confuse the humanitarian operation with the military operations and that you taint, some people say, the humanitarian operation. But I must say, having been in the conflict areas, that I'm glad that there are peacekeepers that can have convoys that reach the most distant and forgiven villages of Sudan. But you have to have a reasonable division of labor. And of course, the dilemma is that there is always a risk that the peacekeeping force is seen as an intrusion, and therefore that we always in peacekeeping operations have to remember that we have to, as it said, win the hearts and minds of people also. When you see a peacekeeper, you should connect him with peace and not with violence. And this is a problem that the United States, of course, has faced in Iraq, and perhaps the NATO forces, and Sweden is one of them, also my own country, is facing in Afghanistan. But we have to make sure that the peacekeeper is seen as a positive factor, someone who brings peace and welfare, in some cases, to the countries. I remember peacekeepers, some of them were Swedes in Kosovo, where the peacekeepers were conscripts and they were maybe electricians or plumbers or carpenters back home. When they got into a village and saw that the woman in the house had problems with her plumbing, they took off their coat and fixed the plumbing. That's the way to build trust and confidence. And I remember a woman soldier, children ran out of a school, they were scared there was shooting, and this soldier, I'm proud to say she was Swede, there are some Swedes here today, I know, she sat down on her knees, you know, like we do when we meet young people, small kids, and with this soldier with weapons and everything, getting down on her feet led to the children climbing on her. And you can imagine that that made that peacekeeping operation in that particular town very popular. So we have to try to do that under very difficult circumstances. And then, of course, another factor that could enhance this respect of the civilian suffering and understanding of the civilian suffering is to give a stronger role to civil society, and I would say particularly to women. I have very, very positive experiences of working with the women in Somalia. I had some problems to sell my negotiation scheme to the men, I must say, at the risk of almost cultural insensitivity, I was told. But I thought I was on the right track. At least the women thought so. And in Sudan, Salim Salim and I, my co-negotiator from African Union, worked very closely with civil society and women's organization. And I must say, used their arguments vis-a-vis the rebel leaders and the government when they so accepted that we brought out their arguments, of course. And they represented practically always the reasonable, down-to-earth, sensible desire to achieve peace and very pragmatic approaches. I think the role of civil society must be enhanced. I think much can be gained from giving civil society a stronger role. I believe, in fact, there is a new possibility here, because with the new communication methods we have, with everything from internet to cell phones and the power of the media, that the pressure can be stronger, the impact can be stronger from civil society. Not even the most isolated dictator is insensitive to the pressure from his own people, who are more and more well-informed and want to see change. And I think women and civil society and particularly women's organization have a tremendous opportunity. And this role has now been recognized. I mentioned Resolution 1820 earlier about rape, but there is another resolution, 1325, which states very clearly, from the Security Council, it's a very strong resolution, it's not the General Assembly, it's from the Security Council, that women must play a stronger role in peace building around the world. And in the new peace building commission, where I was chairing those negotiations, the UN, that role was recognized. Now again, that has to be implemented in reality, of course. I mentioned earlier that we are talking about humanitarian access. We have made some progress, although it's being tested in Zimbabwe, it's being tested in Burma, it's being tested now, as I urgently, I said on an urgent basis earlier, in Sudan. But when it comes to violations of human rights, there is very little progress. Because this is seen by most countries, partly in the Security Council, but also in the General Assembly, as interference in internal affairs. Humanitarian intervention was introduced as a concept in the early 90s. It was rejected very, very quickly by a majority states as a political Trojan horse used by Western powers to undermine regimes that they didn't like. Now there is a new concept that I would like to remind you of, which is an extremely important new way of looking at this problem I began responding to the question, does solidarity stop at a border or at human beings in need? And that is the principle of responsibility to protect, R2P, as it's called in diplomatese, R2P, responsibility to protect. It is actually a way of saying that if sovereignty is so important, why not then accept that sovereignty implies that you protect your own population from genocide, ethnic cleansing, mass killing, etc.? And that every state has a responsibility to protect its own population from genocide, ethnic cleansing, mass killing, etc. This principle was accepted. It's on paper. On the 16th of September 2006, this was stated in the General Assembly. I had the honor of taking that decision on behalf of 172 leaders from all over the world. This was irrefutable. Nobody could say no to this, you know, what I just said. But the problem was the next paragraph. For those who would like to get into diplomatese again, you could look at the second part of that paragraph, where it says that if a country does not live up to the obligation to, or the responsibility to protect its own population, then the international community, through the United Nations, has a responsibility to act. But there comes the restrictions, I'm sorry to say. Because there it says that, yes, it has to be done on a collective basis, and I don't mind that. I think it's correct that it should be on a collective basis. No individual state should take the right to intervene. Collective basis, but then it's also as appropriate and other sort of limitations that you can imagine in the diplomatic life. And then, of course, this ends up saying that the responsibility in the end lies with the Security Council. And there, of course, you know that the veto power often has prevented action. So, in a way, we are back to square one, but the principle that every state has a responsibility to protect its own population is now laid down. And I think we and you who represent the university world and perhaps civil society and the private sector, or the media, need to bring that principle out and remind the leaders of the world that that responsibility exists. So print it out, enlarge it, frame it, and put it inside all government quarters in the world to remind them. I will end by putting all this in the larger context. And that is what I said to some of you before we came into this room, that it is time that we put the peaceful solutions in the center, and that we realize that very rarely are there military solutions. And that indeed the most civilized thing we can do is to prevent conflict from erupting. And that if there is a risk that conflict erupts, mediation and other peaceful means should be employed. There are two key chapters of the UN Charter. Chapter 7, the use of force. And I am not a pacifist to the degree that I don't think that the United Nations should have the chance or the possibility to use force if necessary. But there is also Chapter 6, which is my favorite chapter. Chapter 6 has the beautiful, almost poetic heading, Pacific Settlement of Disputes. And it is not used to the degree that we should. We are losing far too many lives, losing so far too much money, losing the reputation of international organizations and our night's sleep, because we wait until conflicts erupt. And therefore, I think we should use the Article 33 of the UN Charter, which is Christmas Eve for a diplomat. Listen to this, what we should do before conflicts erupt, and ask yourself, is this being done? The parties to any dispute shall first of all seek a solution by negotiation, inquiry, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, judicial settlement, resort to regional agencies or arrangements, or other peaceful means of their own choice. How often do we do this? Very rarely. And I think it's time to give the word a chance and give the dialogue a chance and talk and try to find solutions before the conflicts turn into the nature that I've described in my earlier part of my presentation tonight. And then also understand in this more larger context that while we try to work for our world in peace, we must see the interrelationship between different pursuits of a peaceful world. When Kofi Annan delivered a report to the General Assembly, when I was president, we thought of a good way of beginning the document that was adopted on the 16th of September. And we had a sentence which I think sounds like this: no peace without development. No development without peace. But no lasting peace or sustainable development without the respect of human rights. In other words, peace, development, and the work for human rights are the same. If one of these three pillars is not there, you have an unstable situation which usually leads to conflict, poverty, or continued violations, of course, of human rights. They all belong together. So we have to break down walls. You do that in the Joan Kroc Institute in a very good way, because on this level, it has to be done also on the university level. See that relationship between economic development, social justice, human rights, and peace and conflict resolution. I only regret that we didn't add a fourth dimension, which I still think is necessary for this to work, and that is we need also good governance. We need to have governments that are willing to seriously deal with these three aspects. And unfortunately, there is a great deficit in good governance in large parts of the world. So that's the larger context in which I would like to put this. And also say, perhaps, that this cannot be done by one party alone, by one nation alone, by one organization alone. The problems of today's world are so huge and so complex that no one can do it alone. You look at the conflicts with regional and international implications, but look also at the so-called global threats, which are both national, regional, and local. Environmental degradation, climate change, communicable diseases, particularly tropical diseases in the developing world. You see the organized crime, migration. Who could ever imagine that these problems can be solved by one, who, however powerful one may be? I'm very glad that the new president of the United States, President Obama, so clearly has stated that we have to work together. I think that's the only way. And that if we don't choose that road of strengthening international cooperation, we will start to look inward, and we will build walls again. Protectionism in the trade area and in the human side, we will divide humanity into us and them, and we look at the outside world as a problem. So we have to strengthen that international system and deal with these problems together. And by doing that, we have to try to deal with this sense of hopelessness that exists so much. I notice When I go around in Sweden or elsewhere, in many parts of the world, I notice that people think that the problem are so huge that I can't even fathom it. I don't want to see it. I turn off the television. It's too much. I wish I could do more. And I say, I think it's time we realize that everybody has a responsibility. Not anyone, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And in the on these global issues, I think we need to look for a new international division of labor, where, of course, on the global level, the United Nations has a role. In the economic sphere, the Bretton Woods system needs to be definitely reformed after what we have seen in the financial area recently. But we also need to strengthen regional organizations. These regional organizations and arrangements are part of the UN Charter. The founders of the UN thought that primarily problems should be solved on a regional basis, then go to the United Nations. That was the intention in Chapter 8 of the UN Charter. And then government's responsibilities, of course, and the private sector, and then, of course, the non-governmental organizations, civil society, and you and me. And by identifying the role for each and putting the problem in the center, the role for each in dealing with these problems, like getting clean water, if I had water in this, I have water in the bottle. But you know, this, if this were filled with water, I would say this is a luxury for 1.2 billion people in the world. 2.5 billion people don't have sanitation, toilets, to put it very simply and directly. This is what the main reason for the spread of disease and child mortality in the south of Sahara. I've seen it myself, dehydrated children, women who have walked for 2 hours to get clean water, and then they drink this dirty water and the child is dehydrated and dies. To unite around one concrete problem like this, and then have a division of labor, who does what, that could lift away this hopelessness and also add an ethical dimension to our agenda. If this could be on the agenda of President Obama and the European Union now, when we discuss our cooperation in the security field, whether it is NATO or other issues or trade, if we could add this global dimension, can you imagine the difference that could make in the world for millions and millions of people, plus to us add an ethical dimension to our foreign policy and enhance the standing of Western democracies in the world. And in all this, we need to have, and these are my final words at this stage, we need also to have energy. I often say, I said it to my children first, but I said it now to my students also, that you need to have in life passion and compassion. You need to be really engaged. You can't disappear in the mass of communications and speak less clearly. You have to stand for the principles you believe in and do it with passion. Without passion, nothing happens in life, on any level, I was about to say. But without compassion, the wrong things happen. So if we go to work with passion and compassion, seeing the realities which are unbelievably difficult to take in, maybe even in this room when I described it, and I've seen parts of this myself with my own eyes, and I decided that this would not make me sleepless, but rather give me anger that... It gave me anger, but put that anger into action. If we can use that energy and work with passion and compassion to deal with these issues, realizing that the problems are of the magnitude they are, then we can lift away that hopelessness and achieve a better world for those who have the responsibility to take over from us and do an even better job than we have done. But at least we must all be able to say we tried our best. And let's at least aim for that. Thank you very much.
In terms of those periods of time that you talk about, I mean, the disappointments that came, the possibilities now, disappointments that we didn't solve things better at the end of World War II, World War II, or didn't understand the potential we had, and subsequently in the 80s, at the end of the Cold War. What's the one thing you see now is the most positive opportunity for us to actually get it right in the future?
Well, I think there is a tremendous power in civil society. It is probably a new factor. I was surprised myself to see the degree of human rights organizations and women's organizations working so openly and being so active in a country which is not sort of seen as a democratic country. And this was an irrepressible force. They are so strong, they could not be stopped. And I loved to hear their voices, and this was new. There's really a movement that has to do with education, of course, but also I think the power of communications, the internet, the messages across nations. It is impossible to isolate yourself today. So I think civil society, and not least the role of women, is very hopeful. And then, as I said at a discussion earlier today, I'm also very much encouraged by young people in the universities. Wherever I go, the curiosity, the interest in doing something, the desire to play a role, the desire to go out and find out for yourself, realizing that Shakespeare was right in Romeo and Juliet when Lorenzo says to Romeo, "Remember, there is a world outside Verona." We have to remember there is a world outside Verona. Shakespeare is always right. And I see this in the children, among the young people. In my generation, we were so ideological in Europe, you know, left and right was fighting each other, and we were very dogmatic, I think. Now, I find the students more like, you know, in a positive way, the H.C. Andersen fairy tale, The Emperor Without Clothes. The little boy who says he has no clothes, and asking those absolutely elementary but very important questions. So I hope very much for the new generation and civil society out there in the world. And then also, I must say, the fact that a president is here in the most powerful country in the world, who is seen as very much a symbol of reconciliation and belief in human dignity and belief that working together, that has done tremendously, made a tremendous impression all around the world. And if we can then get Europe and US to also accept a global agenda that I described earlier, maybe that could also be a sign of hope. So by that, I want to thank you for inviting me to San Diego.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.